to Merseyside Sport. The Kickoff.
Radio City Talk.
Okay, let's have a look at a brand new book written by one of the top football authors. Simon Hughes has penned a new book called On the Brink. It's a journey through English football's northwest. I suppose it's where is football in 2017? It's a look at the landscape specifically across our region, but it's fascinating because it covers clubs from Southport to Barrow, right through to Liverpool, and sort of looks at what makes success. Morning to you, Simon.
Good morning.
So why the book? You've really taken a diversion on what you would normally write.
Yeah, well, I've done a trilogy of Liverpool Football Club related books, and this was one that, you know, I'd thought about for quite a long time, because I started my journalistic career covering non-league football. And, you know, appreciate really how important that is, you know, like in terms of the way people feel about it, particularly in smaller towns. But what I wanted to do was kind of link up, you know, the every level of football and write about it in one place, because, you know, I'd read a lot of different football books, obviously, and there's not many books that do that about the present. You know, there's a lot of historical books. I mean, this has got a bit of history in, but I wanted this to be, as you said, about 2017 in the Northwest, which is, you know, English football's most successful football region. But, you know, try and explain through the eyes of the people who are at the different clubs, the challenges that they face. So I hope it just reflects what it is like at this moment and a change in time for not just for football, but for society. You know, there's been so many drastic, you know, decisions being made in government and elsewhere over the last couple of years. And that feeds, I was trying to explore how much that feeds into football and how much football feeds into society as well, about the way people feel about general things. So the book's quite a lot of things, really. There's a lot of, you know, exploring how geography impacts on the success of a football club, how industry defines how people feel about it, and I suppose where finance is leading the game.
It's quite a bit on football emotion.
Yeah, as well. Yeah, well, I found that, you know, speaking to people, particularly, you know, the high profile people. So I've just mentioned kind of the smaller clubs there. I mean, I went to speak to Jurgen Klopp at Liverpool and Sean Dyche at Burnley, for example, two contrasting characters. And, you know, I did find that they're within a book, they kind of understand that there is a bit more room for context, you know. So I suppose the pitfall of a newspaper, although obviously I love the newspaper industry and work in it, the pitfall of it is that there's a lack of space, I guess, in the actual papers themselves. Sometimes you might get a great interview, but the editor will say, well, we've only got 800 words here, you know. And so within a book, you know, you can provide all the necessary context to explain the level of emotion, you know, that's in the game. Because, you know, managers particularly, that the managers are under so much pressure now. I mean, Sean Dyche said, you know, that managers are essentially the spokesman for the football clubs now, because, you know, a lot of other clubs that are owned by rich, you know, foreign businessmen who aren't immediately accessible. So the narrative of football, narrative's a very, you know, kind of modern word. The narrative of football is very much led by what the managers say. And I was keen to explore, you know, the impact of that as well.
You spoke specifically in one of these chapters with Peter Ridsdale, because you mentioned there about the fact that some people don't like giving interviews in football because they don't feel they get their message across. Now, Peter Ridsdale's a classic example of this, ridiculed in many quarters, specifically across the Pennines for his financial transactions. But he got the chance to have his say within your book, taken on at Preston.
Yeah.
And doing some remarkable things. When you approached him, was it almost a chance to say, look?
Yeah, well, I just said to him, I mean, you can't separate Peter Ridsdale from what happened at Leeds. You know, in common consciousness, he is responsible for the meltdown of Leeds, you know, which is a club that still suffers from that period of time. Now, you know, I didn't want the interview to just be about what happened at Leeds, but inevitably, when you're having a conversation with him, that's where it leads.
You have to
explain it. So, I did find that one a particularly, you know, interesting one. I mean, he said that he didn't want to. He does very few, seldom does interviews now, for that very reason. I mean, ultimately, he's got to take some blame for what happened. He was in charge there, but if you actually read the interview, there are some mitigating circumstances, and I suppose he took himself out of Leeds at a time where he wasn't able to. It was like 18 months before Leeds plummeted, you know, and he wasn't able then, that he wasn't able to control what was being said then, because he was out of sight and out of mind. So he felt there were a lot of people speaking about him when he wasn't really there to defend himself in a position of power to do so. So, I mean, he subsequently obviously gone into a few different football clubs. And, I mean, genuinely, everybody you speak to at Preston just can't speak highly enough, you know, of the work that he's done there. So, I mean, I'm certainly not an apologist for Peter Reedsdale, but all I can try and do is explain emotionally how he feels about where he's at the moment and, you know, give his side of the story whilst bringing, obviously, a bit of balance to the discussion.
I mean, the interesting part of his career path was that he got such bad headlines, but that someone with such a high-profile business acumen as Trevor Hemmings, owner of Blackpool Pleasure Beach and many other massive organisations, identified him as someone who could spark a massive change within Preston Football Club.
Yeah, well, I think that in football there's definitely a, you know, a tendency. I mean, I think now with football there's PR, you know, PR counts for so much, and there's a lot of people who've made, I suppose, high profile mistakes in football, and as a consequence of being rendered incapable of being involved in football anymore. When, you know, the reality is that, I suppose, as they get older, they're a bit more perceptive about the pitfalls of the business and actually might be more suitable for it. But, you know, it's how the fans react when that happens. You know, I can think of a few people, you know, who, you know, for example, Rick Parry at Liverpool got a lot of criticism for his time there. And, you know, I don't know whether he'd ever be able to get back into Liverpool, but if you speak to him now, I interviewed him in a previous book, I think he's actually probably got quite a lot of business sense who could contribute positively in some kind of role somewhere. And this is where it comes to, I think, with a lot of people now. You know, we kind of, particularly in this age of Twitter, where everything's either good or bad, there's no middle ground, you know. And I just think that there might be sometimes opportunities for people who haven't quite done things that everybody agrees with, but that doesn't mean that they're hopeless.
The other thing we do in this modern day of football is build them up to knock them down. Rick Parry's one of those. At one time, he couldn't put a foot wrong.
Yeah.
You know, Peter Ridsdale's one of those as well, isn't he? And it seems like there's far more attention on those who run the football clubs. And you've really delved into this in the book.
Yeah, well, I mean, I wanted to go everywhere, really, and just see exactly what is making football tick and the motivations behind football at the moment. I mean, as you said, I went to Barrow, which, you know, for me is a fascinating place because it's so remote. I mean, how does a football club exist there? I mean, the reality is it needs backing and finance, you know, a heavy level of finance. You know, I explored the intriguing situation on the Fylde Coast where you've got Blackpool who've gone from the Premier League all the way down to League Two. Obviously, they got promoted last season. And there's a new challenge there now, you know, Fleetwood, Fylde. These are clubs that are trying to, you know, challenge the establishment, I guess. It's a bit, you know,
the Cod War, as you put it.
Yeah, it's a little bit like, you know, kind of the Brexit situation in many ways. You know, and then in Merseyside, that was an important passage for me because obviously I'm from Liverpool. You know, there's a few angles in there, which I think, you know, I'm hoping that people will find interesting. You know, I went, the one that I really enjoyed doing the most was going around with Home Bargains FC in the FA Sunday Cup, you know, the amateur team who've been well established in this city for a long time. And, you know, it was described as the holy grail for them to win this competition. And you could just see, you could really, really see what it would have meant, you know, for them to, unfortunately, they didn't win it last year. But, you know, it was encouraging to see that level of passion amongst kind of grown men who obviously become quite cynical about, in the cynical football world, it really meant so much to them. Whilst obviously talking about how the amateur game has changed, because it's quite clear to me in writing this book that the Premier League affects everything, you know, every level of football, it trickles down, whether it's finance, emotion, whatever. You know, I mean, very basic thing at amateur level is, you know, it's becoming more difficult to get players to play on a Sunday because the games in the Premier League kick off so early. So players now are just, you know, not turning up sometimes. And I think that's unhealthy.
Steve Hothersall's Kickoff. This is Radio City Talk.
My guest is Simon Hughes, author of On the Brink. He's visited a variety of North West football clubs. We can't get through them all. Too many to make. In fact, how many clubs did you visit?
It must be over 30. I mean, I did quite a lot of interviews that didn't actually feature in the book as well because I wanted to make sure there was a flow between each passage.
They give a different idea of where different football clubs are at and their ambitions, their love and how the geography affects them. So interestingly, you start the book up in Cumbria. Yeah. And you talk with Danny Granger, captain of Carlisle, at the time when the floods hit Cumbria in 2015, devastating floods. Yeah. And you sort of tell the story at the beginning of this of the perception of what it meant for the floods to hit the area. Well, why did that feed in?
Well, I think that particularly with Danny Granger, who, as you say, is the captain of Carlisle, I just found their geographical existence fascinating. How a club which is so far away from any of the, you know, metropolitan areas exists, you know, how what it needs financially to prosper and thrive, whether it can ever, you know, be, you know, a Premier League club, if you like, because it's a one, you tend to find these one, you know, city places where there's a lot of passion and tend to jump on the bandwagon when things start going well. But I think if you look at Carlisle's history, they've only been in the first division once in the last 40 odd years, I think. But Danny Granger, he's the captain of Carlisle and the only Cumbrian player in the team. So obviously that says that a lot of players come from elsewhere in the country to go and play for Carlisle. The club has to pay, you know, the club has to pay inducements to get players to go and play there. And particularly when you've got the floods as the disastrous in 2015, and I was intrigued to find out how that affected the club, because the club played an active role in the community in actually, you know, getting rid of the floodwaters. Danny Granger, the actual captain, he spent all of his career playing in Scotland. So I found that angle interesting as well, particularly in this academy-led era where so many players in football in the Premier the Football League now have been touched by Premier League academies at some point. You know, they've been in and dropped out, whereas he was one who hadn't and has actually gone up to play in Scotland. He actually had to go and play in Scotland because of the foot and mouth crisis in the early 2000s when his farm was shut down, which meant that he couldn't play football in the local leagues and couldn't get to Carlisle to play for the youth team, at which point he got released by Carlisle and went to play for Gretna. So, you know, it just shows you that there's a bit of luck as well in all these things. And I know people like to kind of boil football down to a statistic as a definitive reason as why things happen, but the reality is, you know, these kind of issues can actually affect, you know, the way life occurs, I guess.
There are a few Merseyside to Cumbria links, not least Jeff Twentyman,
you
mentioned in here. So there are some people raised in Cumbria who've had a big impact on Merseyside.
Yeah, well, that was another angle from me that interested me, because Jeff Twentyman was a person I wrote my first book about his scouting at Liverpool. He was a scout for more than 20 years at Liverpool and attracted a lot of the best players to the club through his scouting methods. And, you know, it just proves that there is an eye for football talent in Carlisle, a place that is far away from people's minds and people's consciousness, I guess. And, you know, it can't be underestimated what he did for Liverpool. Very kind of modest man who rarely spoke a word, but I suppose in this modern era where, you know, scouting seems quite high tech, really, you know, a lot of statistical analysis, a lot of his methods were down to the trained eye.
Now, Barrow's a fascinating club, and you spoke with the chairman, Paul Casson. Barrow, of course, based at Holker Street. And he speaks in the book about his frustration of supporters heading to some of the bigger cities to watch their football. What is there in it for smaller teams in smaller conurbations these days? How on earth do they achieve success if fans are always going to follow the path to a Liverpool, an Everton, a Manchester United, who are relatively accessible?
Yeah, I think the challenge for football clubs such as Barrow, you know, is enormous. I mean, the one thing I would say is Barrow's geographical location is actually quite unique, really. I mean, I think they're further away from any football league ground than any other football league team in the country. Obviously they're in the conference, aren't they? But you know, you get what I'm trying to say. So you know, he's an interesting character, Paul Casson, because he actually was born in Barrow and left the town in the 1970s to live in America, where he built a telecommunications company just before the internet like kind of boom. So obviously made a hell of a lot of money, and he was interested in getting back involved in Barrow 2 years ago, but was finding it quite hard because the club had had a previous owner who took the club in a direction that the fans didn't want, almost to the brink of extinction. So we found those negotiations quite hard. The reality is, it was actually a local newsman that revived, you know, the possibility of this happening. And because he phoned Paul Cass and said, look, you know, like, I've been told that you're the mystery buyer. Like, what's happening? You know, you should be doing this. And it just proves to me, you know, the importance of local journalists really making phone calls, because in this time at the moment where we've got a lot of local newspapers closing down, including in this city, it just shows you that if you've got like a local paper asking serious questions, good things can happen. Because there's no doubt, you know, Barrow's financial position's improved in the last few years. The fans are starting to go back. The attendance have gone up a little bit. They've had a bit more success. He's not outspending, you know, he's not spending a huge amount of money to try and, you know, to reach the Football League. And he seems to be quite realistic about it. So I just think that, you know, there's a wider story to be told there, just how important, you know, local news, you know, including, you know, Radio City. You know, it's important that people, you know, now we tend to go, you know, for the big newspapers. I still think it's really important. News organisations, I just really think it's still important for local places to have a news outlet where you're going to have journalists who are going to ask serious questions, and then from there good things can happen as well. I think people
built a sense of community, which is very much what he wants.
Yeah, and he's facing, as he said at the beginning, he's facing a difficult challenge, because every Saturday when Barrow are playing, there's busloads of people going out to Manchester and Liverpool to watch those clubs. So he's got to try and do something a bit different to try and draw people back in. I mean, there's always been a struggle for local clubs, let's be honest. I mean, you know, when smaller clubs within the region, you know, it's never been easy for them. But I just think the threat now is greater, because the gap between the top and the bottom is getting further and further and further away, to a point where there'll have to be some kind of restructuring, or, you know, there will be some clubs that will, you know, go out of existence, I'm sure of that.
One of the most fascinating chapters in this book is that I'm reading about Barrow, then all of a sudden you go into this story about Curtis Warren, his arrival in helicopter in Blackpool. Go on, paraphrase it for us.
Yeah, well, there was a bit of mystery around who owned Barrow in the mid-90s, and nobody was quite sure. There's a great story in a book called Cocky, which again was written by a Liverpool Echo reporter, a number of Liverpool Echo reporters. And this story is taken from there, where, you know, Curtis Warren apparently was on a helicopter ride, and people thought that he wanted helicopter lessons, which he may have done. But apparently he was flew over the scudding seas of the Irish Sea towards Barrow, and he was heard pointing at Barrow's ground saying, "I own that." So, you know, that I guess we'll never know the truth.
Your guide to Merseyside sport. The Kickoff. Radio City Talk.
Brand new book out that should definitely be on your reading list. It's by the superb Simon Hughes, and it's called On the Brink. He's looked at a load of different football clubs in the Northwest. Let's talk managers. And you went from both ends of the scale, really. You mentioned Sean Dyche before at Burnley, who's a fascinating character, so we'll talk about him in a second. Before him, Liam Watson, of course, who had his own love affair with Southport Football Club. Times aren't always easy at that level of the game, and the pressure is unbearable, seemingly.
Yeah. I think there's a perception that the job of management is somehow easier the lower down you go, because there's fewer people interested, I guess, in what you're doing. But I've spoken to quite a few non-league managers, you know, over the years, and it's quite clear to me that the pressure on those guys is just... a lot of them are walking away from the job because the sheer commitment that you need. I mean, now in non-league, the whole financial kind of landscape has changed in the last 10 years. I mean, you've got the Conference, you know, and more or less, I think all but five clubs this year are full-time in the Conference, which means they're all pushing to get into the promised land of the Football League, where the money that the clubs will receive is far greater. So clubs are taking more risks to try and achieve that, whilst there's only one promotion place and a playoff place. So there's going to be a lot of unhappy, you know, chairman, directors, owners at the end of that season. Meanwhile, that has a kick-on effect for the Conference North, because you've got four or five clubs in the Conference North this season that are full-time. So it's not really semi-professional anymore. At the same point, you've got you've got bigger distances to travel because the Conference North covers a much greater space of land. Below that, you've got the Evo Stick League, which used to be really a northern league. Now, I think you've got 12 clubs south of Birmingham that are in that league. So all of this contributes to more pressure for the managers because obviously some managers might have a little bit more money and other managers that don't, that aren't full-time, are competing against that. So they're all under pressure to either sink or swim at a level that wasn't there before because of the level of finance involved. So, you know, I know a lot of managers that are just, you know, talented managers that have had success at different non-league clubs that have just decided it's unmanageable anymore. And as a result, I suppose we're now finding more coaches are going into non-league, you know, guys who maybe have had a little bit of success with the academies because they see that as their career path. So the traditional style non-league football manager is disappearing. I mean, Liam's story is a slightly different one because his son, you know, is at Accrington Stanley and he wants to devote the time that he's got to him. But perhaps, you know, if there wasn't so much pressure, he could balance the two. I don't know, but, you know, he's been a non-league manager for a long time and I guess that he's obviously made the decision that, you know, now it's his son's time, which I think everybody would be able to understand. But there's no doubt that the job at every single level of football is becoming much, much, much more pressured.
And some of these guys are juggling it with other jobs. I remember going off to interview Liam as his job as a physical instructor at Ashworth Hospital.
Yeah.
You know, he was actually juggling the demands of being the Southport manager with almost a semi-full-time job in a really important environment. And at the time, I remember saying to him, I can't believe you can actually balance this.
Mm.
And he said, well, there's no other way to live my life, to earn the correct amount of money. And I remember him saying there wasn't much home time.
Yeah, it's the same for players as well. I mean, I know quite a lot of non-league football players and they've... I do see that they don't quite love it as much as they do. And I know we kind of think of non-league as this kind of alternative to the rich, money-led Premier League. But I don't quite see it like that. I mean, now non-league teams are populated by ex-academy dropout players. So in the past, you know, 15, 20 years ago, a lot of non-league teams included a bulk of players who'd probably played amateur football on a Saturday and a Sunday and being good enough to push up through the level. So there'd be a level of pride if you were playing for Marino, Prescott Cables or somebody else, Bersko, because you were on the way up. Now, a lot of the academy players are on the way down and you see non-league as like, how have I ended up here? That also means that, you know, they see themselves as professional footballers. You see them on Twitter. It's like non-league players, you've been non-league players for 3 or 4 years, bio, professional footballer. It's like, well, you're not anymore. You know, you're not a professional footballer. That has an impact because when another club offers them a bit more money, they'll go, you know, particularly if they're on non-contract, which means there's more transients in non-league. So in the past where you'd have teams that'd stick together for a long period of time, and you go into the clubhouse and you have a beer with the players. Now that's changing every couple of months now because players are just moving on, understandably to some extent. So I think the landscape has changed dramatically in the last 20 years because, as I said, I started up, you know, writing about non-league football, so I've seen this change. You know, whether it could ever go back to the way it was, I'm not quite sure because now, you know, for the reasons that I explained in the home bargains chapter, which I mentioned earlier, you know, it's becoming more difficult even to play Sunday league because of financial commitments for people as well. You know, like if people have got work on a Sunday, you know, they've got to take that work. You know, they can't just turn it down.
Or they might be going to the match.
Or they might be going to the match.
Right, someone very much with his feet on the ground is Sean Dyche. There's a great line in here. He could be the Lord of Winterfell. that really struck a chord there. You spoke to him about lots of things. Looked at budget versus club. But also the sack the manager syndrome. Was he quite open to this conversation? It's something that we've felt for 10, 15 years that, oh, he's not done well for a month. He must be on the verge of the sack.
Mm. Well, I found Sean Dyche was great. I mean, I asked very few questions in that interview. He just kind of got a lot of things off his chest. And, you know, bearing in mind, I suppose Burnley is seen as one of the more stable football clubs. You know, this isn't something that's directly affecting Sean. It's something that's he's seeing on the outside and feels confident enough to speak about it, which, you know, I think he deserves quite a bit of credit for that because he could just sit back and think, well, I'm all right kind of thing. And he can see the way it's gone. You know, he's seen the change as well. And I think from he's... one of the few managers in the book who was an ex-player who's seen that change, you know, from the 80s till now. So I think he was perfectly kind of placed to speak about this big change. And I mean, he, despite him apparently being on a, you know, kind of a relatively easy job, you know, if that's the way people see it, I mean, it's not the way I see it. You know, I think, any level of football is a massive pressure. I mean, what I found interesting with him is, I mean, he actually lives in Kettering and his family are in Kettering, and he travels, you know, backwards and forwards every week. He sees the Burnley job really like working away. You know, that's the kind of, you know, like a fella on the oil rig kind of thing. You know, he related it a bit to that. So yeah, I mean, he had some very strong opinions about the way, you know, the way club ownership has changed the dynamics of appointments and sackings, really. And you know, I think Sean is seen as that, you know, like the little Englander who always champions, you know, English managers getting more of an opportunity. But in this book, he had more of a chance to outline the context behind those theories. And I could understand what he was saying, you know, in terms of the way, you know, with foreign club, with clubs now, a lot of clubs are owned by foreign owners. And they're just more likely to take, the reality is they're more likely to take advice off people they know, you know, which might not necessarily be from that country. So there's a lot more detail and context, and I'd like people to read it and have a little think about, you know, the way they perceive him to some extent. But I mean, you know, the reality is always somewhere in the middle. I was interested to know exactly who he is and what he's really like against, you know, against the caricature of the way people see him. There's a bit of truth in the way people see him, but, you know, it's not always the full truth.
No, there seems quite a deep character there.
Yeah.
Someone who is quite bothered about how he's perceived.
Yeah, I mean, I think he is. I think it does bother him because I think he thinks it hinders his yeah. opportunities as well.
Right, let's get on to Everton. We haven't got that much time left. So moving home is one of the chapters. And you talk about the move to Bramley Moor Dock, but also in relation to the possible move to Kirby that was muted for so long. As you said before, maybe they got out of jail, yeah. Everton, with this. You've examined what it meant geographically.
Yeah, I think, I mean, the Everton move is the whole Everton passage is about the move. And what, I mean, I think the Keogh who were involved in obviously stopping Everton's move to Kirby 7 or 8 years ago don't get enough credit at all for what they achieved there, because Everton never reached the crisis point that they would have reached, I think, if they'd have gone there. You know, if you look at the track record of football clubs, particularly in the last 15, 20 years, that have moved, you know, some distance away from where they're, you know, from where they have traditionally been, it's never ended happily. I went to Bolton and spoke to the people there, and you know, Bolton moved to Horwich, which was 5 miles away, I think, from Bolton town centre. Kirby is 7 miles away. I think it's all hunky-dory when things are going well, but when things don't go well, it tends to be that the football club gets treated out of sight, out of mind, and it's a bit more people suddenly find it a bit more difficult to go and watch the match. And there were lots of details in that story, which I spoke to Dave Kelly about, which, you know, perhaps people don't realise just the level of pressure that he was under and the rest of the group to make sure that didn't happen. And I think they don't get the credit they deserve, because at the time, you know, Liverpool were fighting their own battle with Hicks and Gillette, and that kind of took a lot of the media headlines. It'd be fascinating to see what would have happened if Everton had gone to Kirby. I don't think it would have been a happy arrangement. I think Bramley Moor is the best solution of the proposals that Everton put forward, because it keeps the club right in the centre of the city. You know, it's going to be, you know, it's going to be form a new, you know, a new skyline for Liverpool. So it'll always be there. People will see Everton, and it'll be relevant when it's right in the back corner of a city. You know, it's kind of, as I said, it's out of sight, out of mind.
And well, you talked with Joe Anderson as well, yeah. in some depth here. Does he feel it's a blessing at the end of the day? Did you get the impression that maybe he was full on up for this at one point in time?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I spoke to Joe primarily, you know, about Bramley Moor, and he I thought it was important to try and get like a politician's voice in this, because he has had a key role in getting this agreement over the line. And, you know, he sees, I mean, he obviously gets a lot of stick, Joe, for a variety of reasons. I mean, on this one, you know, I think he's been right to do what he's done. I think, you know, that Liverpool is a city that has struggled for the city council's struggle for finance over the last, you know, since austerity happened. And this is something that benefits everybody, really. I mean, the only people that might miss out is obviously in Walton. But from what I've been told and what I explore in the book, you know, Everton have got some plans for Walton to make sure that the area is still cared for. So I think, you know, with any move, there's always going to be a bit of teething problems. But knowing the way Everton is as a club, I just don't think that I think they're acutely aware of the responsibilities. And I would hope, you know, that Walton, you know, will not suffer, too much from the move.
There's so much more in this book. I mean, barely skimmed the surface here. Some great stuff with Jamie Carragher. Good friend Carragher talking about the pressures of management. He talks about how managers are never the same.
Yeah.
Once they've taken their job. I think that's probably an accurate representation.
Well,
isn't
that's a lead in for the Jurgen Klopp interview, yeah. Really, just because, you know, everybody sees Jurgen Klopp, I suppose, as this kind of really genuine character, which I happen to think he is. But as history is. As proven over the last kind of 10-20 years, the person who enters the Liverpool job is really the same.
Is he still the same now?
Klopp, yeah. Well, he seems to. Yeah, I mean, yeah, he hasn't changed his tact at all. I think he's far more serious than people give him credit for. Far more considered. He's not just this raging manager. He does think about things deeply. You know, I think his big strength is that he sees a world outside of football as well. He just doesn't. He can exist outside the bubble of football, and he's not afraid to say what he thinks as well. And I think that's a strength because a lot of players, react well to honesty. And I think he is honest with players.
And there's some great stuff as well if you're a Tranmere fan with Mark Palios and the parallels with his time at the FA and the time that he's got at Tranmere to try and turn that club around as well. It's a superb book, On the Brink. When's it going to be out?
It's out tomorrow, Steve.
So tomorrow is the launch day. You'll be able to get your hands on it where?
Well, it'll be available from Waterstones in Liverpool One, Pritchard's in Crosby, where I live, so I should mention Pritchard, and, you know, Amazon and the direct from the publisher, De Coubertin, on their website. There's actually a discount from there at the moment. So if you want to pre-order it, you get a few quid off.
Steve Hoddersall's Kickoff. This is Radio City Talk.